Symphony No. 8 in G major by Joseph Haydn, Le Soir, for evening. The New York Philharmonic was conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful work. And of course, Bartók was a great, not only a great composer, but he was a great musician. He was a great pianist himself, and he played this a lot himself, naturally. And somehow, funny enough, I always, my sort of associations when I hear this piece, they go somewhere very far in the history or even prehistory of humankind. I'm thinking of these very, these Ur elements, this kind of the rhythms, and I'm thinking of cave paintings or the most the earliest instruments of humankind, some maybe wind instruments made of bones or something like that. Even the beginning, which it starts with the dialogue of piano and timpani. There's this very powerful drumming, and then violent chords from the brass. One is even thinking of roar of prehistoric animals, so something like that. And also in the slow movement, because it's brilliant, fantastic, ingenious structure in this piece, also with orchestration. The first and last movements are very certainly vivid and fast-moving music with a lot of percussion and a lot of sound, whereas the second movement is very meditative with a reduced orchestra. The strings are not at all there. It's mostly, it's just woodwind, percussion and piano. And also there, I'm kind of thinking of the maybe some associations with the earliest music of mankind. But there is this tremendous joy in the music as well, I think. It's a music you never get tired of. It. It's just somehow so genuine and just full of energy and full of life.
Pianist Olli Mustonen with some introductory remarks to the next work on our program, Bartók's Piano Concerto No. 1. After going nearly 3 years without composing anything, Bartók broke that silence in 1926 with several piano works, one of which was the first piano concerto. The piece, which Bartók wrote with his own talents in mind, is considered to be one of the most technically challenging in the repertoire. It was premiered at the 5th International Festival of the International Society for Contemporary Music in Frankfurt in July 1927. Once again, Olli Mustonen.
Well, I think it's all wonderfully written for piano. It's very challenging, but it's just all motivated by the music. I can't say, I do think it's incredibly well written. I must say, myself, I sort of grew up with the music of Bartók, certainly from very early age. Mm. Bartók was already very important composer for me, not only to play, also I remember growing up listening to his string quartets. We happened to have the scores also, and when I was something like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, I would often listen to all 6 of them in a row, and wow. and somehow it's just the kind of music I grew up with and identify a lot with, and it has its own laws, but when you're familiar with them, it all seems, and these laws are different from other music, but when you're familiar with this, his laws of nature, so to say, all of it makes a lot of sense, and it's a very fascinating world.
The first piano concerto is less informed by folk materials than many of Bartók's more commonly heard masterworks. The composer's signature is still evident in the generally percussive nature of the score, as well as the work's finely crafted and judicious use of dissonance.
Yes, yes, I think you're right. I mean, though the last movement is the one where the folk idioms come most obviously to be heard, definitely. You never forget his background. And I mean, like with all of us, I think our background travels with us through life, and then in Bartók's music definitely there are some other music, which is more obviously connected to Hungarian folk culture, which definitely was very important part of his life, because he was not only a great composer, but he was also, in a way, a musicologist, and somebody who gathered a lot of this wonderful folk music at the early part of his life.
Esa-Pekka Salonen shared these thoughts.
There's nothing in the first piano concerto that could directly relate to any kind of ethnic music. Having said that, I recently discovered that some of the chordal writing, especially in the first movement, does somehow have a resemblance to Hungarian folk music, in the sense that there's a sort of a pedal point around which the harmony kind of revolves. Mm. And it's almost like the harmony has been encapsulated within a small space and confined into a kind of a, almost like a cage, where it's not allowed to move beyond a certain space. And this was a very recent discovery for me. I heard some Hungarian folk musicians when I was in Vienna before Christmas last year in December, and a few phrases of the first piano concerto came to my mind. So no, there's no direct use of folk material, but there's something about the spirit that still brings certain aspects of Hungarian folk music to mind.
And with Oli Mustonen seated at the keyboard, we'll now hear the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Béla Bartók. Esa-Pekka Salonen conducts the New York Philharmonic.
Thank you.
Well, Ligeti, of course, broke away from his origins stylistically and technically in the sort of most spectacular way when he fled from Hungary in 56, chased by Dobermans, by the way. He ran through a forest and managed to get himself to the Austrian side, just barely alive and, you know, having the dogs after him. Then he made it to Vienna and ended up in Cologne, where he met with Stockhausen, who actually gave him not only financial help, but also he was staying with Stockhausen for a while before he had a place to stay. And he went into electronic music. Cologne was, of course, the center of electronic music at the time. And then he, in every new work of his since the late 50s, he kind of broke into new ground every time he wrote a new one, from Apparition to Atmosphere and so on and so forth. And so he really had this kind of idea that every new work has to start from zero, total tabula rasa. A new piece mustn't have anything to do with what was going on before. And of course, practically, this is an impossible task. And but he certainly didn't want to rest on his laurels. He was always forging ahead. And I would say that out of these three pieces, Clocks and Clouds is one of the pieces where he's kind of furthest away from his own origins and the sort of classical, romantic, Western musical tradition. This piece sort of looks into the sort of minimalist world. There are echoes of Terry Riley and some kind of Cajun static but beautiful surface is very evident in this music.
Conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen on the next work on our program, Clocks and Clouds by Gyorgy Ligeti. The evocative title of this work derives from On Clocks and Clouds, an essay by Carl Raymond Popper, a philosopher of science. Apparently, Ligeti was attracted by the title and the musical possibilities it suggested to him. And it's back down to the stage now for Clocks and Clouds by Ligeti. Esa-Pekka Salonen conducts the New York Philharmonic and Women of the New York Choral Artists. Thank you.
Thank you.
Clocks and Clouds, music by Jerzy Ligeti from the early 1970s. The New York Philharmonic and Women of the New York Choral Artists were conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. Our broadcast concludes with the suite from Béla Bartók's ballet, The Miraculous Mandarin. Originally conceived as a pantomime for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, the plot is filled with sexual tension and grisly violence, making it at once sensuous, shocking, and gripping. After its premiere in Cologne in 1926, where it caused a near riot of catcalls and whistling, it was banned by then-Mayor Konrad Adenauer and withdrawn. The work was not premiered in Budapest until 1945, after Bartók's death. Despite its lurid scenario, the message of the work ultimately is about the power of love. Three thieves force a girl to lure customers into their den in order to rob them. A decoy game, Bartók called it. After failed attempts with a penniless old gentleman and an impoverished young man, a Chinese man, the Mandarin enters, symbolized musically by an oriental pentatonic motif. The girl seductively dances for him, and as his passion mounts, he pursues her in a chase accompanied by barbaric music. The ruffians rob him, try to smother him, stab him with a sword, and hang him from the ceiling. Yet he does not die. His gaze remains fixed on the girl, and he begins to glow an eerie blue. Understanding his loneliness, she embraces him, and, as if finally humanized by love, the Mandarin begins to bleed from his wounds and dies. In an attempt to tame the story, the music of the suite, extracted from the full score in 1927, stops just before the murder attempts and the sexual encounter. But even with these sections removed, Bartók's X-rated gripping score about the mysterious Mandarin is full of frenzied, ferocious energy. And back on stage at Avery Fisher Hall is Esa-Pekka Salonen. He'll lead the New York Philharmonic in the suite from The Miraculous Mandarin by Bartók.
Thank you.